All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we unpack complex topics and bring you the most compelling insights from a stack of sources. Today, we're diving into a fascinating historical paradox, the story of a U.S. president who achieved, well, pretty much every major goal he set out to achieve. He dramatically expanded the country to its modern contiguous borders, yet often feels like, I don't know, a forgotten figure in the annals of American history. We're talking about James K. Polk, the 11th president of the United States.
It's quite true. While maybe not a household name like Washington or Lincoln, scholars consistently rank Polk in the upper tier of U.S. presidents. And that's really for his sheer effectiveness, you know, and the sheer audacity of his vision. He was a man of immense focus and determination, a real political chess master who, in just one single four-year term, fundamentally reshaped the map of North America.
Upper tier for effectiveness is quite a claim. What were the specific metrics or achievements that placed him so high in their estimation? And were there contemporary criticisms of his methods? Because you don't reshape a continent without some controversy, right? Our mission today is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge about Polk's incredible journey from a log cabin to the White House, through his intensely ambitious presidency, and into the complex, often contradictory legacy he left behind. Get ready for some surprising facts and maybe some profound historical connections.
What's truly fascinating here, and what we really need to unpack, is how Polk's unwavering vision for a continent-spanning nation, this idea deeply rooted in manifest destiny, well, it not only propelled the U.S. forward into an era of unprecedented growth, but simultaneously sowed the inescapable seeds of future conflict. We'll explore the why behind his relentless pursuit of expansion and its far-reaching implications, particularly regarding the explosive issue of slavery, and, you know, how his single-mindedness, while incredibly effective in achieving his goals, might have actually created problems he just couldn't foresee or maybe didn't want to.
From log cabin to Capitol Hill, Polk's ascent.
Okay, so to truly understand James K. Polk, we have to start at the very beginning. Who was this man before he held the highest office in the land? What were the forces that shaped his character, his ambition? Where did this drive come from?
To really grasp Polk, you absolutely have to appreciate the context of his formative years. You know, he wasn't born into immense wealth or some established political dynasty. He came from a family deeply embedded in the challenging, often brutal frontier life of late 18th century America. And that environment, well, it undeniably shaped his character and fueled his early ambitions.
Born James Knox Polk, November 6, 1795, in a log cabin, Pineville, North Carolina, first of 10 children, a family of farmers. I mean, imagine the sheer grit required just for survival on the frontier back then, clearing land, building a home from scratch, raising a huge family with really limited resources. It really paints that picture of independence and self-reliance that was so central to the American identity at the time.
Indeed. And his family, of Scots-Irish descent, were staunch Presbyterians. This religious background played a significant role, particularly through his mother, Jane. Now, his father, Samuel Polk, apparently had a more relaxed attitude, rejecting some of the more dogmatic aspects of the faith. But his mother, Jane, stamped her rigid orthodoxy on James, instilling lifelong Calvinistic traits of self-discipline, hard work, piety, and individualism. These characteristics, this belief in sort of predestined achievement through just diligent effort, they clearly defined his adult approach to politics and life. It wasn't just a philosophy, it was a deeply ingrained work ethic.
And yet this ambitious young man faced a profound personal trial very early on. Think about the harshness of frontier life, the incredibly limited medical knowledge. And here's this child suffering from excruciating urinary stones. We hear of a planned journey, a long one, to a prominent Philadelphia physician that had to be abandoned mid-trip, just because the pain was too intense.
That's absolutely right. The pain was apparently so unbearable that traveling all the way to Philadelphia just became impossible. Instead, he underwent this successful, though utterly harrowing, operation by Dr. Ephraim McDowell in Kentucky. And get this, with only brandy as an anesthetic, it's just a stark reminder of the brutal medical realities of the time. And it's a procedure that, as many historians suggest, may well have left him impotent or sterile, given that he never had children. But what's crucial here, and often overlooked, is how this near-death experience seems to have forged an almost unbreakable resilience and a singular focus in him, qualities that would undeniably define his political career later on. He actually recovered quickly and became far more robust after this ordeal.
So a really challenging start, but it seems to have forged that resilience you mentioned. And he clearly valued education, pushing himself way beyond the typical frontier opportunities. He graduated with honors from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1818. That's a real testament to his intellect and drive. This wasn't just about hitting the books, though. He also honed his oratorical skills as president of the Dialectic Society. Apparently, he debated figures like Alexander Hamilton there, showing an early alignment with those Jeffersonian principles that would define his political leanings.
Right. After graduation, Polk went back to Nashville to study law under the renowned trial attorney Felix Grundy, who became his first significant political mentor. He was admitted to the Tennessee Bar in 1820, and then his law practice really took off during the severe depression of the Panic of 1819. This economic turmoil, a period of widespread financial distress, foreclosures, it provided him with a flood of legal cases. And crucially, it gave him firsthand insight into the struggles of ordinary people, which probably further solidified his democratic leanings. And, well, it effectively subsidized his nascent political ambitions, too.
But okay, to truly understand Polk's trajectory, his rise, we have to talk about Andrew Jackson, the towering figure of Andrew Jackson. Imagine this. The Polk family wasn't just allied with Jackson politically, they were intimately connected. Sarah Childress, the remarkable woman James Polk married in 1824, she was far better educated, more politically astute than most women of her time, and she even called Jackson Uncle Andrew.
This personal connection was absolutely crucial. Polk quickly became an unwavering supporter of Jackson's political ambitions. He demonstrated that loyalty very early on in the Tennessee legislature back in 1823. He actually broke with his usual allies to cast his vote for Jackson for U.S. Senator. That alliance, well, it would be a cornerstone of Polk's entire career, earning him the nickname Young Hickory, right? A reference to Jackson's Old Hickory. And for our listeners, this wasn't just about patronage. It represented a shared ideological bedrock. Jacksonian democracy emphasized a strong executive, expanded suffrage for white men, a deep distrust of elite institutions like banks, and this profound belief in the common man's power principles Polk would rigorously champion throughout his career.
Right. So with that powerful backing, Polk entered the U.S. House of Representatives in 1825. He famously campaigned so vigorously for that seat that his wife, Sarah, apparently worried about his health. That earned him another memorable nickname, the Napoleon of the Stump. He was immediately a vocal critic of the John Quincy Adams administration, particularly after those allegations of a corrupt bargain in the 1824 election, which he, like other Jackson supporters, absolutely believes unjustly cost Jackson the presidency.
His loyalty to Jackson was, well, truly unwavering. He quickly became Jackson's most prominent ally in the House during the very contentious Bank War. Now, this was a titanic struggle where Jackson sought to dismantle the Second Bank of the United States. He viewed it as a corrupt, aristocratic monopoly that served Eastern interests at the expense of ordinary Americans. Polk chaired the powerful Ways and Means Committee, issuing a strong minority report condemning the bank, perfectly mirroring Jackson's populist rhetoric. He also staunchly supported Jackson during the nullification crisis of 1832-1833, condemning South Carolina's attempt to nullify federal tariffs. He backed the Force Bill, asserting federal authority over state defiance, showed his commitment to the Union in that context.
Then in 1835, with Jackson's continued backing after several terms as a key loyal ally, Polk becomes Speaker of the House. This is genuinely significant. He's the only person ever to serve both as Speaker and U.S. President. That really speaks to his political stature and skill, even back then, right? Shows a mastery of the legislative process.
His speakership, yeah, it lasted until 1839. It was a period of intense political battles, and it demonstrated his pretty rigid control over proceedings. He controversially enforced the gag rule regarding slavery petitions. This was a measure that automatically tabled any petitions calling for the abolition of slavery in D.C. or federal territories. Now, this wasn't just some procedural move. It was a highly contentious attempt to stifle debate on the explosive issue of slavery. It drew fierce protests from figures like John Quincy Adams, who saw it as a profound violation of free speech and the right to petition. Polk also attempted to establish an independent treasury system, separating government funds from private banks, a key Democratic objective the Whigs had thwarted. His thorough grasp of House rules brought a degree of order, but the economic downturn after the Panic of 1837 and the subsequent Democratic losses made it clear his time as Speaker was limited. So he then set his sights on the governorship of Tennessee, seeing it as the next logical step in his carefully orchestrated political ascent.
So what's the lasting lesson from this period of Polk's life? What's really insightful here isn't just that Polk was ambitious, but how he meticulously leveraged that unwavering loyalty to a powerful figure like Andrew Jackson, and how he exploited the specific political landscape of his era, almost like a master strategist playing a long game. He understood that in a deeply polarized system, unwavering allegiance could be more potent than broad popular appeal alone. That's a lesson that continues to echo in politics even today, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. His resilience forged in childhood, combined with this political acumen, made him a truly formidable force.
Governor, dark horse, and the call of expansion.
Okay, so after 7 terms in the House, 2 of them as Speaker, Polk heads back to Tennessee. He runs for governor in 1839. He's aiming to redeem the state for the Democrats after a Whig governor had recently taken office. He'd reached the pinnacle of legislative power, but the national stage seemed to beckon.
Right. He won in 1839, became governor of Tennessee. But the office itself, well, it had surprisingly limited power. Unlike many other states, Tennessee's governor at the time didn't even possess a legislative veto. That severely curtailed his ability to enact his agenda. So he primarily saw it as a springboard for national ambitions. Specifically, he was hoping to be Van Buren's vice presidential running mate in 1840. He believed his southern residents would effectively balance Van Buren's New York roots, especially with the controversial incumbent VP, Richard Mentor Johnson, facing significant opposition.
But those VP hopes were quickly dashed. The Democratic convention endorsed no one for vice president, leaving the choice sort of up in the air. Van Buren ultimately lost the presidency to William Henry Harrison and Polk. Well, he received a single faithless elector's vote for VP. A symbolic gesture at best. It was a clear sign that his national ascent wasn't going to be as smooth as he'd perhaps hoped.
Yeah, and his governorship wasn't particularly successful in terms of legislative achievements either. His major programs regulating state banks, implementing state internal improvements like roads and canals, improving public education, they all failed to win legislative approval. He did manage to secure the replacement of Tennessee's 2 Whig U.S. senators with Democrats, which was a significant political success for his party. But despite that, he then lost re-election, twice, in 1841 and 1843 to a popular Whig opponent named James C. Jones, often called Lean Jimmy. Apparently, Jones effectively countered Polk's serious, almost austere demeanor with a much lighter, more joking, self-deprecating campaign style. These defeats left Polk's political future looking very uncertain. You could argue he was at the lowest point of his career.
But these defeats, they had an unexpected, almost paradoxical benefit, didn't they? The experience of statewide campaigning, even losing twice, proved invaluable for what was coming next. It taught him how to connect with voters across an entire state. And crucially, he maintained the continued support of the aging, but still immensely influential, Andrew Jackson. Jackson remained a formidable presence in Democratic politics.
Precisely. Despite his recent losses and, frankly, fading prospects, Polk was determined to become the next vice president. But here's where the national political landscape takes this incredible turn. The biggest political issue of the time, the one that truly dominated discussions and divided parties, was territorial expansion, especially the highly contentious annexation of Texas.
Yeah.
This issue was about to just explode onto the national stage and fundamentally alter the political calculus.
And the stakes for Texas annexation were incredibly high. Texas, having successfully revolted from Mexico in 1836, was largely populated by American immigrants. Many on both sides of the border saw annexation as inevitable, you know, a natural extension of American settlement and ambition. But critically, it risked immediate war with Mexico. Mexico had never recognized Texan independence and still claimed it as a breakaway province. Mexico viewed annexation as a direct act of aggression, a blatant land grab.
And there was also this significant international dimension that complicated matters. Britain was actively seeking to expand its influence in Texas, hoping to use it as a strategic counterbalance to American power in North America. A key concern for the South, which also played into British diplomacy, was the potential for an independent Texas to abolish slavery, creating a haven for runaway slaves in the West, much like the Underground Railroad in the North. This presented a profound threat to Southern slaveholders, and it just underscored the inextricably intertwined nature of territorial expansion and the explosive sectional divide over slavery, a tension that would define the next 2 decades.
So you have Henry Clay, the Whig nominee, trying for this nuanced, almost fence-sitting position on annexation, wary of alienating voters in both the North and South. Then Van Buren, a Democrat, a former president, also opposed it, fearing a loss of support in the Northeast, recognizing the growing sectional tensions over slavery. But Polk. Crucially, Polk had already written a strong pro-annexation letter that had been publicly published. This was a stark contrast to the leading candidates and put him clearly on the side of aggressive expansion.
This difference was absolutely pivotal. Andrew Jackson, who understood better than anyone the public's growing appetite for expansion, especially in the South and West, realized that no candidate who opposed annexation could genuinely win the presidency. He then decided Polk was the best person to head the ticket, despite Polk initially seeking only the vice presidency. Polk, apparently startled at first by the suggestion he run for president, eventually agreed to accept this unexpected mantle, recognizing the unique opportunity that had suddenly opened up.
So the stage was set then for the 1844 Democratic National Convention in Baltimore. Here's where the dark horse truly emerges. A crucial procedural hurdle was the adoption of the two-thirds rule, a rule stating a candidate needed two-thirds of the delegate votes to secure the nomination. This rule effectively doomed Van Buren's chances, as he couldn't consolidate enough Southern support given his stance on Texas. After seven deadlocked ballots, Polk, who was publicly believed to be seeking the vice presidency, not the top spot, emerges as the ultimate compromise candidate on the ninth ballot.
It was a truly remarkable political coup. His key lieutenant, Gideon Johnson Pillow, along with historian and politician George Bancroft, played a significant role navigating the convention floor, quietly building support. After Van Buren's withdrawal letter, and crucially Senator Silas Wright's refusal to accept the presidential nomination, the path just cleared for Polk. Many delegates, tired of the deadlock, looking for a strong pro-annexation candidate, swung to the Tennessean. No wonder Whigs mocked him with the chant, "Who is James K. Polk?" I mean, he came from seemingly nowhere to snatch the highest nomination. He was virtually unknown to many outside D.C. and Tennessee.
Polk was indeed the first dark horse nominee, but he didn't campaign in the modern sense, did he? He remained in Columbia, Tennessee, following the custom of the time that presidential candidates avoid direct electioneering. Instead, he managed his campaign through extensive correspondence, making his views known via letters to citizens that were then printed in newspapers. This allowed him to maintain a kind of deified distance while still communicating his platform effectively.
And he had to be incredibly deft navigating the complex political landscape, especially on national issues. The tariff issue, for example, a huge point of contention between the industrial North and the agrarian South. He finessed it, stating tariffs should be for revenue, but with fair and just protection for American interests. This position, skillfully ambiguous, allowed him to appeal to both Southern agrarians wanting lower tariffs and Northern manufacturers wanting some protection without fully committing to either extreme. He also had to skillfully manage the third-party candidacy of President John Tyler, also pro-annexation, threatening to split the Democratic vote. That was resolved through Jackson's influence. And Polk reconciled with John C. Calhoun, reassuring him on both Texas annexation and the tariff issue. Very tricky balancing act.
And the campaign itself was brutal. One particularly nasty tactic was the Rohrbach forgery. This widely disseminated, fabricated story claimed Polk had branded and sold slaves. This wasn't just idle rumor. It was presented as a documentary, quote, published in opposition newspapers, specifically by the Whigs. For voters back then, without instant fact-checking, it could be incredibly damaging. Ironically, this smear also drew attention to the fact that his opponent, Henry Clay, was also a slaveholder, maybe neutralizing some of its impact. Polk himself had to carefully craft a public image implying the only slaves he owned were inherited or bought from distressed relatives, a paternalistic image that, well, wasn't entirely true.
Indeed. The forgery highlighted the deep anxieties and moral complexities around slavery even then, how it could be weaponized in political campaigns. Ultimately, Polk won. Slim popular vote margin, but a clear electoral college victory, 170-105. What's fascinating is he became the first president to lose his home state of Tennessee and also his birth state, North Carolina. His victory in New York, where Clay lost crucial votes to the Anti-Slavery Liberty Party, proved pivotal. Shows the subtle but significant power of third parties in close elections.
So what's the key takeaway from Polk's unexpected rise to the presidency? His journey from relative obscurity to the highest office in 1844, it's really a masterclass in political strategy, isn't it? Highlighting the immense power of a clear, popular platform, in this case, aggressive expansionism, combined with strong backing from key figures like Andrew Jackson, and just the unpredictable, often messy nature of convention politics. He wasn't the obvious choice, but maybe he was the right choice for that specific moment in American history. He expertly capitalized on the prevailing winds of manifest destiny, an improbable yet ultimately successful nominee.
Clear and unquestionable, Polk's grand design for America.
So Polk enters office at 49, the youngest president up to that point. A man clearly driven by a singular purpose, he was known as an incredibly hard worker, famously declaring, "I intend to be myself president of the U.S." A clear statement of his determined, hands-on leadership style. And he wasn't kidding. He quickly laid out four incredibly ambitious, clearly defined goals for his single term, and he fully intended to achieve every single one.
That's right. His administration aimed to, first, reestablish the independent treasury system, which the Whigs had abolished. Second, reduce tariffs to promote trade and benefit agrarian interests. Third, acquire all or some of the Oregon country. And fourth, acquire California and its valuable harbors from Mexico. These foreign policy goals, especially, represented the first major U.S. territorial gains since the Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819. It was a truly transformative agenda designed to complete that continental vision of the United States.
That's an astonishingly ambitious agenda for just one term. It's remarkable how focused and disciplined he was, almost like he had a checklist he was determined to complete no matter what. He quickly assembled a geographically balanced cabinet to help him navigate these complex issues. Seasoned politicians like James Buchanan as Secretary of State, George Bancroft as Navy Secretary, he famously demanded total loyalty and confidentiality from them, wanted an entirely fresh cabinet, free from his predecessor's appointees, signaled his intent to be completely in charge and accountable.
With his cabinet in place, Polk immediately turned his attention to foreign policy. And a key, long-standing issue was the Oregon country. This was this vast, disputed territory in the Pacific Northwest, jointly occupied by both Britain and the U.S., based on early explorations. Neither nation, of course, fully acknowledged the prior claims of indigenous peoples who'd lived there for millennia. In his inaugural address, Polk famously declared the U.S. claim clear and unquestionable, a very bold statement that certainly ratcheted up tensions and risked war with a global naval power like Britain.
But this rhetoric, while strong and certainly designed to appeal to expansionist sentiments back home, it actually masked a more pragmatic approach, didn't it? Polk viewed an actual war with Britain over Oregon as profoundly unwise, especially with tensions already rising with Mexico over Texas. He understood the strategic folly of fighting two wars simultaneously. He and his Secretary of State, Buchanan, began negotiations, initially proposing the 49th parallel as a boundary, a reasonable compromise, which Britain immediately rejected, hoping for a better deal.
Right, and let's not forget the powerful popular sentiment often encapsulated in that rallying cry, 5440 or fight. Many Democrats, fueled by the potent, almost spiritual philosophy of manifest destiny, genuinely believed the U.S. should span coast to coast, extending north to 54 degrees 40 minutes north latitude. This wasn't merely a desire for land, it was this ingrained conviction of America's divinely ordained right and duty to spread its democratic institutions and, well, perceived cultural superiority across the continent, often at the expense of indigenous peoples and other nations. Polk, however, chose not to assert a claim to the entire territory in his inaugural address, despite his party's more extreme demands. Showcased his strategic realism, his willingness to compromise when necessary.
So he used tough talk to gain leverage, but was also open to diplomacy. He requested Congress approve a one-year notice to terminate the joint occupancy agreement with Britain, a move that, while seemingly aggressive and again raising the specter of war, effectively prompted Britain to reopen negotiations. This was further spurred by their domestic repeal of the Corn Laws, which opened British markets to American wheat, and a renewed desire for good trade relations with the U.S., which was, let's face it, a more valuable prospect than a distant, sparsely settled territory.
Exactly. The Oregon Treaty, ratified in 1846, ultimately divided the territory largely along the 49th parallel, which was precisely what Polk had originally desired and proposed. Britain retained all of Vancouver Island and limited navigation rights on the Columbia River for the Hudson's Bay Company, a compromise that averted war. Polk's willingness to push right to the brink, while alarming to many in Congress and the public, likely secured better concessions than a more conciliatory approach might have achieved, demonstrated his shrewd negotiating style, his belief in assertive diplomacy backed by a strong stance.
Okay, so with the Oregon dispute settled, Polk's focus sharpened, and all his immense willpower was then directed towards the other major territorial prize, the American Southwest, specifically California and New Mexico. The stage was set for a much more direct confrontation this time.
Yes. Even before his inauguration, President Tyler, seeking to bolster his own legacy, had moved to annex Texas, which Polk strongly supported, and indeed his election was seen by many as a mandate for it. Once Texas officially became the 28th state in December 1845, tensions with Mexico, which had never recognized Texan independence and still claimed it as a breakaway province, escalated dramatically. Diplomatic relations had already been severed by Mexico back in March 1845, a clear sign of impending conflict.
So Polk immediately began preparations for war, strategically deploying Brigadier General Zachary Taylor, who would later become president, down to the Rio Grande. Now, this was a highly provocative move because Texas claimed the Rio Grande as its southern border, while Mexico vehemently insisted the Nueces River further north was the true boundary. By sending Taylor's forces directly into the disputed territory, Polk was making a clear assertion of U.S. intent, a direct challenge to Mexican claims. It was an almost certain path to conflict.
Indeed. In late 1845, Polk sent John Slidell to Mexico. A diplomatic mission, yes, but with a very clear, even audacious objective, to purchase New Mexico and California for $30 million and secure Mexico's agreement to the Rio Grande border. However, Mexican public opinion was incredibly hostile to any territorial concessions, and President José Joaquín de Herrera refused to even receive Slidell, viewing it as a profound insult and a cynical pretext for war, especially given the presence of Taylor's troops right there. A military coup soon brought a hardliner, General Mariano Paredes, to power, who pledged to take back Texas by force. Diplomacy under these circumstances had failed spectacularly.
So with diplomacy dead in the water, the situation just rapidly spiraled. April 25, 1846, a skirmish on the north side of the Rio Grande in the disputed territory, known as the Thornton Affair. American casualties. Polk receives word on May 9th. He quickly sends a war message to Congress, famously claiming that Mexico had shed American blood on the American soil, unquote. He presented it as an unprovoked attack on American troops, a clear casus belli.
Congress overwhelmingly declared war just days later, though not without significant opposition and heated debate, especially from Northern Whigs. Despite the seemingly lopsided votes, the war deeply divided the nation. Many Northern Whigs, abolitionists, even some pacifists, opposed it, believing that Polk had deliberately manufactured the conflict solely to expand the institution of slavery and increase Southern political power. Figures like Abraham Lincoln, then a young congressman, famously questioned the precise spot on American soil where blood was shed. This underlying sectional tension, ignited by the war, would only intensify as the conflict progressed and as new territories entered the Union. It was unavoidable.
So what's the key takeaway from Polk's single-minded pursuit of these goals? His unwavering commitment to his objectives, even risking war with two major powers, demonstrates a powerful, almost singular focus in presidential leadership. His handling of the Oregon and Texas situations, combining tough rhetoric with pragmatic diplomacy and decisive military action, set a precedent for assertive American foreign policy and significantly shaped the nation's future geographical and political landscape. He truly believed in America's manifest destiny and executed a clear strategy to achieve it.
War, conquest, and domestic transformations.
All right, the Mexican-American War was on. And it quickly became evident that Polk faced challenges not just from Mexico, but also from within his own military and Congress, creating a very complex, at times almost chaotic, presidential environment. It was far from a simple conquest.
Right. Initial American victories at Palo Alto and Resaca de la Palma definitely boosted war support back home, proved the military's effectiveness. However, Polk deeply distrusted his two senior Whig generals, Winfield Scott and Zachary Taylor. He feared their burgeoning popularity and, frankly, their potential presidential ambitions. He even considered replacing them with Democrats, though he felt Congress wouldn't approve. Highlights the deep partisan divisions even during wartime. And then, in a highly controversial and ultimately disastrous move, he tried to use the former Mexican president Antonio López de Santa Anna, who was exiled in Cuba, hoping Santa Anna would negotiate a peace treaty and territorial cession if returned to power. A huge gamble.
And get this detail, it really shows the political maneuvering at play. Polk actually lifted the naval blockade to allow Santa Anna's return to Mexico. But Santa Anna, once back on Mexican soil, instead of negotiating, immediately organized a formidable military defense of his homeland. He exploited the opportunity Polk had given him. Polk was effectively snookered, as historians have called it, and this profound miscalculation prolonged the war for at least another year, costing more American lives and resources. It's a striking example of a shrewd political mind being outmaneuvered on the international stage, a rare misstep for Polk.
Meanwhile, U.S. forces were making significant territorial gains out west, almost independently of the Central War effort. Under Brigadier General Stephen W. Kearny, American forces captured Santa Fe, the capital of New Mexico, in August 1846 without firing a shot, took control of a vast, sparsely populated territory. Almost simultaneously in California, John C. Fremont, supported by a pro-American Bear Flag revolt in Sonoma, and Commodore Robert F. Stockton captured California's key ports and secured the region. By late 1846, the United States held effective control of New Mexico and California, acquired immense new lands, but also created immense new problems.
And these vast territorial gains, yeah, they immediately ignited an intense sectional debate over slavery, foreshadowing the Civil War even as the fighting in Mexico continued. Polk's request to Congress for $2 million to purchase Mexican lands, anticipating a peace settlement, led to the infamous Wilmot Proviso. This was an amendment introduced by Pennsylvania Congressman David Wilmot that would ban slavery in any acquired territory from Mexico. It passed the House, highlighting Northern opposition to the war's expansion of slavery, but died in the Senate due to Southern resistance. This discord was a clear and alarming indicator of the growing chasm between North and South, and it significantly contributed to Democrats losing control of the House in the 1846 midterm elections. The issue was just becoming inescapable.
So to finally bring the war to an end, after realizing Santa Anna was definitely not a reliable partner, Polk ordered a decisive invasion of Mexico's heartland. General Winfield Scott landed his forces at Veracruz in March 1847 and began a march toward Mexico City, employing some brilliant tactical maneuvers along the way. At the same time, Polk dispatched Nicholas Trist, Buchanan's chief clerk and a fluent Spanish speaker, to accompany Scott's army and negotiate a peace treaty. Trist's instructions were clear: seek the cession of Alta California, New Mexico, Baja California, and the Rio Grande border for up to $30 million.
Scott's forces secured decisive victories at Contreras and Churubusco, culminating in the capture of Mexico City in mid-September 1847. With the American army occupying the capital, Trist began negotiations. However, the Mexican government was in disarray, initially unwilling to give up much territory, leading to frustratingly slow progress for Trist.
Right. Frustrated by this perceived lack of urgency and Trist's perceived failures, Polk recalled Trist in November 1847, ordered him to return home immediately. But here's another fascinating, almost audacious twist. The diplomat famously ignored the order. Convinced he was on the verge of a breakthrough and that abandoning negotiations would prolong the war indefinitely, Trist remained in Mexico City to negotiate the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. This defiance absolutely outraged Polk. He even considered having him forcibly removed and court-martialed. However, in a display of pragmatism over personal pique, Polk ultimately decided to allow the negotiations to proceed. Recognized that despite Trist's insubordination, the treaty secured the very terms he had sought all along.
So February 6, 1848, the treaty was signed. It granted the U.S. the Rio Grande border as the official boundary with Mexico and formally ceded Alta California and New Mexico for $15 million. This effectively ended the war and, with the exception of the later Gadsden Purchase, solidified the modern contiguous borders of the United States. Polk, despite his anger at Trist, accepted it, pragmatically fearing that if he rejected the treaty, the Whig-controlled House would refuse further war funding, leaving the nation in an expensive, unresolved conflict.
With the war concluded, the focus immediately shifted to organizing the vast new territories. Polk was anxious to establish governments for Oregon, California, and New Mexico to bring them into the Union. He attempted a pragmatic solution, hoping to avoid further sectional conflict, by seeking to extend the 36-degree 30-hour line of the Missouri Compromise into the new lands. This would have allowed slavery in places like Southern California and parts of New Mexico, but explicitly prohibited it in Oregon and Northern California, including San Francisco.
But this proposal for extending slavery was fiercely debated and ultimately defeated by a bipartisan alliance of Northerners in the House, really demonstrating the growing power of anti-slavery sentiment and the inability of past compromises to solve the present crisis. In 1848, Polk did sign a bill establishing the territory of Oregon and explicitly prohibiting slavery within it, a victory for anti-slavery forces. However, the issue for California and New Mexico, further exacerbated by the massive influx of people due to the California Gold Rush of 1849, would only be resolved later by the Compromise of 1850, highlighting that Polk's expansion had profoundly destabilized the national political balance.
And beyond the territorial expansion and the war, Polk also diligently pursued his domestic goals, showing that same relentless focus. He immediately pushed to reestablish the independent treasury system, a core Jacksonian principle where government funds were held in the treasury separate from private banks, thereby preventing speculation and perceived corruption.
Mm.
This system had been established by Van Buren, but abolished by the Whigs under Tyler.
Despite significant congressional delays and opposition from those who favored a national bank or state banks for depositing federal funds, Polk signed the Independent Treasury Act into law in August 1846. This system would remain in place with only minor modifications until the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, a truly significant and lasting fiscal reform that many presidents had tried and failed to achieve. It was a cornerstone of that Jacksonian vision for the economy.
He also targeted tariffs, that perennial source of contention between agricultural and industrial interests. He directed his Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Walker, to draft a new, lower tariff, aiming to reduce protectionism and stimulate trade. This became the Walker Tariff of 1846, which significantly reduced the rate set by the Protectionist Tariff of 1842.
And despite intense lobbying from protectionist interests, especially from the industrial Northeast, and Vice President Dallas having to break a tie vote in the Senate, which was a politically challenging move for a Pennsylvanian like Dallas, whose constituents were largely protectionist, Polk signed it into law. This tariff, combined with the fortuitous repeal of Britain's corn laws the same year, led to a boom in Anglo-American trade, ushering in a period of economic prosperity, another checkmark on his ambitious list.
Interestingly, Polk, much like his mentor Andrew Jackson, was firmly opposed to federal funding for internal improvements like the Rivers and Harbors Bill. He vetoed such bills multiple times, including a significant one for $500,000 to improve port facilities and navigation. He saw these as unconstitutional intrusions into states' rights and a source of potential corruption and wasteful spending. Believed such matters were for the individual states to handle, not the federal government. This is a consistent philosophical stance throughout his career, reflecting his strict constructionist interpretation of the Constitution.
So, what's the profound implication of this segment? This reveals Polk as a president who didn't just have an ambitious list of goals, but possessed the rare political will, the shrewdness, the sheer determination to see them through, often against significant opposition, both foreign and domestic. His executive power during wartime was pretty unprecedented. However, it also lays bare the profound impact of his decisions on the sectional divide over slavery, which, despite his successes in expanding the nation, set the stage for much greater future conflicts, turning what he saw as secondary issues into the nation's primary existential threat.
A president's enduring mark and personal paradoxes.
So Polk accomplished all four of his major presidential goals, fulfilled a continent-wide vision for the United States, cementing its place as a burgeoning world power. But what happened after his single term, and what's his true historical legacy, is a story of triumph, certainly, but also of profound, often tragic, unintended consequences, consequences that maybe he could not, or perhaps would not, fully grasp.
Well, during his term, Polk made two appointments to the Supreme Court. Levi Woodbury of New Hampshire, a recess appointment who was later confirmed, and Robert Cooper Greer of Pittsburgh, who also gained confirmation. Greer, notably, would serve until 1870, and he would later write a concurring opinion in the infamous Dred Scott v. Sanford case, stating that slaves were property and could not sue, thereby denying them legal personhood. This directly links Polk's judicial legacy to the escalating slavery crisis and its ultimate devastating Supreme Court ruling.
And true to his word, Polk declined to seek re-election in 1848. Making him one of the few presidents to make and keep such a pledge. Believing in the democratic principle of rotating power, he was undoubtedly disappointed by the Whig victory of Zachary Taylor, the very general he distrusted and often clashed with. He had a rather low opinion of Taylor, seeing him as someone with poor judgment and limited political skill. Nevertheless, Polk observed tradition, attended Taylor's inauguration, and famously left a clean desk behind, a symbol of his organized and efficient approach to the presidency.
Polk left office utterly exhausted. By his years of relentless public service, he literally worked himself to the bone, frequently suffered from debilitating illnesses, perhaps due to the stresses of the office and his constant labor. He embarked on a prearranged triumphal tour of the southern United States, but fell gravely ill, likely with cholera, which was rampant at the time. Despite a large reception in Nashville, he died on June 15, 1849, just 103 days after leaving office at the tragically young age of 53. He has the shortest post-presidency of any president not assassinated. His last words, traditionally recounted as, "I love you, Sarah, for all eternity I love you," certainly reflect the deep, enduring bond with his wife. She had been his confidant and political partner throughout his career. His remains have even been moved twice, a restless end for a man of such singular driving purpose.
So, what does this all mean for his place in history? How do historians weigh his accomplishments against the profound issues he either overlooked or exacerbated? Scholars consistently rank Polk highly, praising his effectiveness, his unparalleled ability to promote and achieve his entire presidential agenda. He profoundly transforms the presidency itself, especially in its power as commander-in-chief during wartime and its oversight over the executive branch.
Yeah, John C. Pinheiro noted that Polk accomplished nearly everything he set out to do. The acquisition of Oregon, California, and New Mexico, the positive settlement of the Texas border dispute, lower tariff rates, the establishment of a new federal depository system, strengthening the executive office. He truly produced a new map of the United States, transforming the nation's physical presence on the continent. Amy Greenberg also credits him with masterminding and prosecuting a war that, despite its controversies, turned the United States into a world power, poised for global influence and economic might.
But here's where it gets really interesting and complex, though. While he undeniably made the U.S. a nation poised to become a world power, historians also critically point out that he either didn't fully see, or perhaps chose to ignore, the looming crisis that his actions profoundly exacerbated. It's a profound historical paradox. A highly successful president whose very success inadvertently created monumental problems for the nation.
Absolutely. David M. Pletcher stated that Polk, like many of his time, failed to understand that sectionalism and expansion had formed a new explosive compound. He was just too focused on the immediate geopolitical gains. Frederick Greenstein noted his lack of far-seeing awareness of the problems that were bound to arise over the status of slavery in the territory acquired from Mexico. Unquote. This blindness, or maybe willful ignorance, to the long-term devastating consequences of his expansionist policies, particularly concerning slavery, is a significant point of historical critique. He built an empire, but destabilized the very foundation of the nation in doing so.
And the effects of his foreign policy didn't just touch geography. Amy Greenberg pointed out that the Mexican War he engineered became the training ground for the Civil War. It forged a new generation of military leaders like Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, Jefferson Davis, who first experienced military command, honed their tactical skills, and built their reputations on the battlefields of Mexico. The very war that expanded the nation provided the crucial leadership and experience for the conflict that would tear it apart just over a decade later.
And we really can't talk about Polk without addressing the issue of slavery head on. It's central to the complexities of his legacy. He owned slaves for most of his adult life, inherited some from his father's estate, purchased many more for his Mississippi cotton plantation. It was a product of his time and region, yes, but also an active participant in the institution.
He was indeed a slaveholder who increased his slave ownership significantly during his presidency. He reinvested earnings from his plantation into purchasing more slaves, sometimes buying young people 10 to 20 years old, often without their families. He even replaced the paid White House servants with slaves from his Tennessee home, effectively using his private property to run the presidential residence. A stark reminder of the pervasiveness of the institution right at the top.
And he was very secretive about these purchases, enjoining his agents to keep his private business from the public, likely for political reasons, to avoid criticism from the growing anti-slavery movement. Discipline on his plantations varied. Some overseers described as relatively indulgent, but others, like Ephraim Beanland, were described as heartless brutes who administered harsh treatment, even to runaways. Demonstrates the brutal realities of the system. His will did contain a non-binding expectation that his slaves be freed after both he and Sarah died, but the 13th Amendment ultimately abolished slavery in 1865, well before Sarah's death in 1891, making his personal provision moot.
Like Jackson, Polk saw the politics of slavery as Well, a secondary issue compared to the grander goals of territorial expansion and economic policy. He viewed it as a constitutional right of states and individuals, not a moral wrong, sought to manage its political fallout rather than challenge the institution itself. But his expansionary successes, while fulfilling manifest destiny, absolutely redoubled its divisiveness. Transforming what he saw as a secondary issue into the nation's primary existential crisis, leading directly to the events of the 1850s.
He fundamentally supported the expansion of slavery's realm, his views informed by his family's own history of settling Tennessee with slaves, viewing it as a natural part of westward migration. He believed in Southern rights, both the right of slave states to self-governance on the institution and the right of individual Southerners to bring their slaves into new territories. While he opposed the Wilmot Proviso as an unconstitutional infringement on those rights, he also condemned Southern agitation, accused both sides of using slavery for political gain. Reflecting a desire to contain the political fallout and maintain party unity, even as his policies were directly fueling that very discord.
So what's the enduring lesson here? Polk's legacy is a stark reminder, isn't it? That even highly effective leaders can be blind to the long-term, unintended consequences of their actions, particularly when those actions are tied to deeply entrenched societal injustices like slavery. His single-minded pursuit of expansion, while undeniably shaping the modern map of the United States and elevating it to a world power, inadvertently intensified the nation's most profound internal division, contributing directly to the nation's eventual fracture and the tragic Civil War. It really shows that even the most successful presidencies can contain the seeds of future catastrophes. Outro. So what a deep dive into James K. Polk. He's such a historical paradox. The dark horse who became one of America's most effective presidents, dramatically expanding its borders, fulfilling the vision of manifest destiny, yet often remembered only in footnotes. His name overshadowed by the giants he served with and the conflicts he, perhaps unintentionally, ignited.
His story truly underscores how pivotal moments in history can be shaped by individuals with immense willpower and clarity of purpose. But also, how their immediate, undeniable successes can lay the groundwork for profound future challenges. He gave the U.S. its modern, contiguous map, an extraordinary achievement in one term. But his actions undeniably exacerbated the divisions that would ultimately lead to the Civil War, a conflict he couldn't foresee or prevent, despite its clear origins in his policies.
It certainly leaves you with a lot to chew on. Here's a provocative thought for you to mull over as we close. Polk's single-mindedness was key to his success, but also, arguably, to his historical blind spots. Could a leader with a broader, maybe more nuanced vision have achieved continental expansion while simultaneously mitigating, rather than escalating, the crisis of slavery? Or was the expansion and the sectional conflict just so deeply intertwined that one simply could not happen without the other, regardless of who was in the White House at that moment? Makes you wonder.